Okay, I want you guys to cast your mind back into the deep, dark past approximately 4 weeks ago. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands who remembers what I talked about, so I'll remind you a little bit. The parable that I went through then, we focused on the word righteousness and what the meaning of righteousness was, but within that parable, there was a small thing that happened. It was the tax collector. In his prayer, he says, God, make an atonement for me, a sinner. He's pleading with God to make an atonement. We're going to talk about what that atonement means today. So for the Jews, the atonement sacrifice happened when a lamb was slaughtered, and the blood of the lamb symbolically covered the people's sins. The Torah explains to them the connection between the blood sacrifice and the atonement, so they had a really good idea of what was happening during that atonement sacrifice. So then we as Christians, now we look at the atonement sacrifice as Jesus' death for us. So the question is, how do we as Christians get to the idea that Christ died for us? So Paul talks a lot about that, and he has developed from his knowledge of the Torah and from his knowledge of Jesus' life on earth and Jesus' words and actions, Paul develops for us a really good idea of what the atonement sacrifice means. But an interesting question is, when Jesus was alive and walking on the earth, what did he think of the atonement sacrifice? And we have a pretty good picture of this. And that's what we're going to look at today. There's a English theologian named Leslie Newbegin who has come up with an interesting question. He says, if we fall into a well and are drowning and someone jumps into the well to save us, and in the process loses his life, we have no question about the love of this person and the sacrifice that they made for us. But if we're running through the desert being chased by a tiger and our friend jumps into the well and drowns, what's the connection? So Jesus has connected that for us. We're going to take a look at this story where Jesus connects this. Turn to John 8 if you have a Bible. If you have an app, go to John 8 if you'd like to just use the notes that I provided for you. Go ahead and look at those. Those of you out in cyberland, Ted has a really good idea on how to fix this problem so that you guys can all see the notes, and we'll implement that next time I speak. So I'm going to read John 8 here for you in a minute, but first I want to talk a little bit about this. There's a problem with this story in the Bible, and this is what the problem is. In the earliest written copies we have of the New Testament and of John in particular, this story does not appear. But it starts appearing later on, and so translators have long been wondering what to do about this. Does this really belong in the chronicle of early Christianity? And pretty much most serious theologians say, yes, this does belong. For some reason, it got dropped out, and there's a lot of people that have ideas about why it got dropped out. But the story itself has all the hallmarks of authenticity. It's got the hallmarks of, it is definitely a Jewish story. It's definitely told in a Jewish way. It uses Jewish language. It uses Jewish rhetoric and Jewish format. And it comes from the right period. So most, like I said, serious scholars include this. Sometimes it's included in the book of Luke. I've never seen in any of our English translations that it is. Almost always, though, it's included right here in John, beginning of chapter 8. So I just wanted to get that out of the way, because if you're looking like in a paper Bible, there's probably like brackets around this story and a footnote explaining this. But I just want you to know that even though it's not in the earliest parts, it has been passed down orally until somebody did finally write it down. And in an oral culture, passing things orally was really super important. In fact, if you had something really important, you memorized it and spoke the words rather than writing it down. If it wasn't as important, then you wrote it down in an oral culture. So it probably is. And I am moving forward with the idea that this is an authentic story that we can learn about Jesus from. So I just wanted to get that out of the way so that you know. Before I start reading too, I just want to tell you what has just happened. So Jesus has attended the Feast of Tabernacles, which is one of the major Jewish feasts. It lasts for 7 days. And on the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus has drawn the wrath of the Jewish leaders and the Pharisees onto himself for things that he said. And I would love to go into that because it's a fascinating story, but it doesn't belong, and we don't have time, and so I'm going to skip it over, and I'll just have to come back to it some other time. So anyhow, let's read John 8. Early in the morning, after the last and greatest day of the feast, early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. Placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that he might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And they continued to ask him. And he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Once more he bent down and wrote in the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on sin no more." Okay, this story, when we read this and we understand it from our Western perspective, what we come up with is something like this. We have a woman who has been snatched from the arms of her illicit lover and dragged and dropped into the temple in front of Jesus. She is being accused by men who have probably enjoyed her favors in the past. We look at her as a figure to be pitied. We feel sorry for her. And then Jesus points out the hypocrisy by writing the men's names in the dirt and maybe the dates that they sinned with her. The men get embarrassed and they leave, and then Jesus acquits the woman. There is no punishment involved. And we're happy at the end of the story. It has a happy ending. Those mean and nasty guys, they got what they deserved. The jerks, right? Okay, the woman who we feel sorry for, she gets off. Nobody gets hurt. And it's a story about forgiveness. For some. Some people get forgiven, but not everybody in the story gets forgiven. So that's what we take away from the story often. What I would like to do today is unwrap the story and let's look at it at a deeper level. So to start out doing that, I want to explain the story structure. Okay, so for those of you that haven't heard this before, this is in the form of a chiasm, which means that there are 7 different, statements. I still haven't come up with a good word to call them. That's why it's important that you're looking at this so that you understand what I'm saying. The 7 different statements, I have them labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, so the ones are parallel to each other. The twos are parallel to each other. The threes are parallel to each other. And then 4 is the center. If you remember, in a chiasm, the center is where we want to focus to get the meaning of the story. So go down to this part right here, and that shows you what the parallels are in this story, which also shows one of the, this is one of the things that show that this is an authentic Jewish story. So in the statements labeled 1, okay, the first statement and the last statement that are labeled 1, we have the woman's sin is being addressed. In the first statement, the woman is presented as a sinner. In the last statement, the last number 1, Jesus addresses her sin. Okay, so look at the 2 now that are labeled 2. Jesus in the crowd, and the crowd asks Jesus, "What do you say?" And then the second one that's labeled 2, this is Jesus and the woman alone, and Jesus says. This is what Jesus says. 3, really easy to find the parallel in 3. Jesus is writing in the dust in both of those. And then number four is about throwing the stone, throwing the first stone. Okay, so I want you to understand this so that you'll understand why we're focusing where we are, because this is where the focal point of the story is. So we're going to start with the outer statements, number ones, top and bottom, and then we're going to work our way in, right? Okay, first I want you to know what the setting is, though. Jesus is in the temple, and this is kind of important. It's the day after a major feast. In the temple courtyard, there is three sides that are open, kind of like porches or porticos. And during major feasts, the Romans had a very strong presence because it's during the Jewish feasts that insurrections can start to happen. In fact, the Jews are expecting Jesus to start an insurrection sometime during one of the major feasts. So the Romans have guards surrounding three sides of this temple court where Jesus is, and they've stepped up the guards. So there's lots and lots of guards. So just lining the three sides. When Jesus and the people come into the temple, they're just there. They just have to deal with them. It's part of religious life in Jerusalem. And those Roman guards, they're kind of important to the story. Even though we don't hear about them, we have to know that they're there. So, the day after the feast, also you need to remember that it's considered, regardless of what day it falls on, it's considered a Sabbath day. So all of the Sabbath rules are in effect on this day that Jesus is teaching in the temple. So the first thing we see is the scribes and Pharisees bringing a woman who's been caught in adultery. So this woman is presented as a sinner. There's no question that she's a sinner. The writer just says, yes, this woman is a sinner. She was caught in adultery. Jesus at the end of the story acknowledges, yes, she's a sinner. Yes, she needs to go and sin no more. We don't need to question that. A lot of people want to, as we feel sorry for the woman, we want to say, well, maybe she was raped. Maybe she was abused by a relative. Maybe she is a victim in some way. And so we want to feel sorry for her. The writer of the story wants us to know, Nope, this woman is a sinner. So that's not an issue. We don't have to discuss that. If we say that she's a victim, what we're doing is we're belittling God's ability to forgive. So we have to know right off, this woman is a sinner. How she got there, whether she was snatched out of bed and dragged into the temple, or whether she was just known to be a sinner, not important. Not important to the story. Just the important part is that she is a sinner. So the Jewish leaders, the scribes, are teachers of the law. So that's another phrase that you might be reading if you're looking in a Bible. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, they want to ask Jesus a question. And the answer to the question isn't really all that important to them. We learn that they're setting a trap for Jesus. So how is this a trap? The question seems fairly straightforward. Should we stone her or should we not? So here's what the political situation is. The Romans have just taken away the Jewish judgment council, which is called the Sanhedrin. They've just taken away the Sanhedrin's right to inflict capital punishment. And when I say just, I mean like just, like this year that Jesus is standing in the temple. We don't know exactly, you know, because when we get close to the change from BCE to CE, BC to AD, for those of you that are on the upside of the ages. So those dates get a little bit murky, but somewhere right in here, according to ancient historians, they've taken away the Sanhedrin's right. It hasn't trickled out yet to the provinces, but right there in Jerusalem, they no longer have the right to put people to death. So only the Romans are allowed to execute someone. Only the Romans are allowed to pass a death sentence. And the Jewish people know that if they take an adulterer, a prostitute, to the Romans, they're not going to pass a death sentence. They're going to be like, dude, what do you think's happening here? So when they come to Jesus and say, should we stone this woman? First of all, the Jewish leaders are angry because their religious freedoms have been taken away. Just taken away. This is important to them because when someone breaks a Jewish law, the Jews feel like God is not going to bless them. So they want to bring everybody in the Jewish community under their idea of the umbrella of what God wants from them. So if there's somebody living outside of the Jewish religious system, they want to bring those people in by either punishment or to get rid of them if they have to. So this woman is a symbol of God is not going to bless us until everybody follows his law. So they're angry at this woman for her lifestyle, for what she's been doing. They're angry at the Romans for taking away their religious freedoms, because this is part of their religion. Moses commanded us to stone such people. We can't do it. We can't follow God's law because the Romans aren't allowing us to. So mostly they're angry at Rome. So the question becomes not, should we stone this woman or should we not stone this woman? The question really is, whose law should we obey? Should we obey God's law or should we obey the Roman law? I will take a moment to comment that I will leave it to you to apply this to our own day and age with our religious freedoms disappearing, how we should react to them. So maybe you'll find your answers in this story. So here's where the trap is. If Jesus says, go ahead and stone her, let's follow Moses' law, let's stone her, the crowd will take her out of the city and begin the process of stoning. But the Roman guards are going to intervene because it's going to be a huge blow up, and that's what the Roman guards are there for. They're going to arrest the people who started it, and everyone's going to say, Jesus started it. It's Jesus' fault, right? Jesus is going to get arrested. That's what they want. Great. Jesus is not going to be an issue anymore. He'll be thrown in prison, and that'll be the end of him. But if Jesus says, no, we can't stone her because Roman guards, guys, come on, then he's going to be discredited in the eyes of the people that he's teaching, because what kind of Messiah is scared of the Romans, right? Okay, so that will suit the Pharisees and the teachers of the law also. But Jesus does something here that I consider to be really brilliant, and you'll find out why in a minute. When they ask him this question, he stoops down and he writes in the dirt. Now, this has been a big question since the story came to the notice of everybody. What did Jesus write in the dirt? Okay, there's all kinds of answers to that question. The answer that we like the best is that he wrote the names of the men, the woman's accusers. He wrote their names, and then he wrote the sins that they had. They read those, they got embarrassed, and they went away. Some theologians will say that he wrote Bible verses in the dirt. Okay? I have a little trouble with that because, I mean, there was no Bible verses. He couldn't write like Jeremiah 17:13 because there was no 17:13 in the book of Jeremiah. But that's an idea that some people have, that he wrote Bible verses saying everyone has sinned. So because everyone has sinned, we can't pass judgment on one person that has sinned. One of my favorite ones, because it made me laugh out loud, was that Jesus was doodling in the dirt to gain time so he could gather his thoughts. Right? Because the creator of the universe needs time to gather his thoughts. He already knew what he was thinking. Okay, so naturally, since everybody has an answer to this question of what did Jesus write in the dirt, I too have an answer. So I'm going to tell you what my answer is. First of all, how dirty do we think the temple floor was? They sweep it every morning. Jesus was there in the morning. Okay? Not a whole lot of dirt to write in. Second of all, how big was the crowd? There probably was at least 23 Pharisees and scribes who brought her to Jesus. And of course, there's a lot more people there. How many rows back do you think you'd have to be before you couldn't read what Jesus was writing anymore? If I stooped down and started writing something right here, How many of you can see what I'm doing? Okay. They only recognize it because I wrote his name in the dirt. I didn't get that far. I didn't want to go there. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't matter what he wrote in the dirt. It's not what he wrote in the dirt. It's the point, the fact that he wrote in the dirt. Writing in the dirt was symbolic for something that all the Jews, all the teachers of the law, all the Pharisees would understand what he was doing by stooping down and writing in the dirt, regardless of whether they could read it or not. So it's not what he wrote, but it's that he wrote. So we need to understand what they would already have understood. So I already mentioned that today is a Sabbath day, not today, but the day that Jesus is in this situation is a Sabbath day. Certain rules govern what you're allowed to do on the Sabbath day. First of all, the Sanhedrin, the judges' council, they're not allowed to meet. They haven't met for the whole 7 days of the feast, and they're not allowed to meet on the day after the feast. So there has been no trial for this woman. That means there's been no sentence passed. So if there's an execution here, this is going to be a lynch mob. It's not going to be a legal execution. It's unlawful. And if they do it on the Sabbath, they're breaking the Sabbath. So they have just broken two laws, the Sabbath law and the Jewish laws of justice. Okay, so here's what a trial would look like. First of all, it's a judge's council. 23 men would be on that council. And there are very strict rules about how it's allowed to proceed. Okay, one of the strictest rules is about witnesses. There has to be at least two eyewitnesses, and they have to have a lot of details that mesh with each other to be considered valid witnesses. One of the main rules about a witness is that it has to be a male, and it has to be someone who keeps the commandments. Okay, and that can be kind of important. It doesn't mean they have to be sinless, but it means that they have to keep the commandments, especially the one related to the atonement sacrifice. Because if they sin, whether they do it on purpose or whether they do it by accident, if they're covered by the atonement sacrifice that happens in the temple, it's as if that sin didn't happen. The sin is covered. Okay, so actually somebody could be considered without sin on any given day if they've participated in the atonement sacrifice. Okay, here's an important part. When someone is sentenced in this court of law, their name is written down, the charge is written down, the verdict is written down, and the punishment is written down. There is a record kept of all that. Okay, now stoning. How does the stoning procedure work? I told my grandson I was going to talk about this. I was hoping he'd be here so he could listen to it, but he's not. This is how the stoning procedure worked. It was not a free-for-all like kind of picture it. I don't know where that comes from. Maybe that book that we were forced to read in seventh grade called, I think it was called The Lottery. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Wasn't that horrible? Why did they make us read that book? Anyway, stoning is not a free-for-all. How stoning worked is there was an execution ground. The criminal would be taken to the execution ground. Sometimes they were pushed off of a height onto a rock table below. Sometimes they were just laid down on the table. And then, this is the really important part. The accuser would be the overseer of the execution, and the witnesses are the executors. So the first witness would throw the first stone. It was not a little stone that you could hold in your hand, but it's a big stone, and it was dropped onto the person. If the person was still alive after the first stone was dropped, the second witness would do the same thing. If the person was still alive, then the rest of the crowd would start throwing smaller stones at the person until they were dead. But it's important to understand that it was the witnesses that threw the stone. Okay, so, and if there's two witnesses, the older one did it first. right? Okay, so hang on to those ideas because they're going to come back up around again. Okay, so the person that throws the first stone, if they're doing it against Roman law, not only is Jesus going to be blamed, but the witness too. So both people are going to be arrested. Both people are going to be taken to prison. So the person that throws the first stone is going to have to be willing to go to prison along with Jesus if this happens. Okay? So, hang on, I lost my place in my notes. Okay, yes, here we go. So, Jesus writing in the dust. We're on the number threes now. Jesus stoops down and he writes in the dust. What he's doing, and what the Pharisees and teachers of the law know that he's doing, he is elevating what's happening from a lynch mob to an actual trial by writing in the dust, and he's writing out the victim's name, or I mean the accused name, what she's accused of, the sentence, and what the punishment is going to be. When he's writing that, people who can't see what he's writing, but they know he is writing, they know that this is what he's writing. But here's an interesting side note. Writing on the Sabbath, not allowed. It's against the rules of the Sabbath. You could not write on the Sabbath. So there could be no permanent record made of this woman's sin on the Sabbath. But it was okay to write in the dust. And sometimes the Sanhedrin would use this idea of writing in the dust when they needed to pass a sentence, but they knew that it could not be carried out. So the Sanhedrin, in those situations, would write in the dust of the floor of where they were meeting. The wind blows it away. It's not permanent. It's gone. So Jesus, stooping down to write in the dust, what he has done is moved the lynch mob, elevated it to a trial. There's no permanent record. And so he is making to them a very strong statement that even though he's upholding the Mosaic law, Moses said, stone her, he's upholding that by writing out her sentence. It can't be carried out because the wind blows it away. So Jesus has convicted her, he sentenced her, and then he set her free. And he says to the leaders, you who are without sin. Okay, so this is not talking about past sin. Like I said, there very well could be men standing there that have been covered by the atonement sacrifice. They could stand there and claim to be sinless at that point in their life. But he has just shown them, Jesus had just shown them that what they're doing is a sin. They are breaking the Sabbath laws by trying her in the first place. They're breaking the Jewish laws of justice by not going through the proper procedures. He is not comparing their sin with hers. It's not like, okay, you guys are worse sinners, so we're not going to punish her. Okay, there's no comparison going on there. Adulterer, hypocrites, who's going to draw the line? Who's going to say which is worse? But what Jesus is addressing is their willingness to break the law to uphold another law. So they'll break the law to kill a person, but they won't break the law to heal a person. So Jesus has demonstrated this. This is all demonstrated by writing in the dust. Okay, who is without sin? Cast the first stone. Okay, now we have to ask, is Jesus setting a precedent here? Does this mean that our justice system can't be, when I say ours, I mean like national, every nation? Every people group has a justice system. Does that mean that we can no longer have justice systems if we can't pass judgment unless we're perfectly and completely sinless? Is Jesus setting a precedent for this? The answer on that has to be no, of course, because no justice system could possibly exist, and he's given us a justice system. He set one up for the Jews in the Old Testament, and we've adapted that for us as a Christian nation, and other nations also have adapted that justice system. If we say that, and we do this actually, we say, you can't judge me not necessarily in a formal court of law, but we say that to each other. You can't judge me. You're a hypocrite. You're a sinner too, so you can't tell me. You can't come to me and tell me to stop sinning because you sin sometimes too. That's not what Jesus is trying to do here. The whole first stone idea is anchored in the Jewish justice system, which, like I told you, the eldest witness drops the first stone. So he's talking to these people one at a time when he says, if you're without sin, then cast the first stone. He's talking like to the oldest guy in the room. If you are without sin, you cast the first stone. If a witness does drop the first stone, killing the criminal, and it turns out that they were a false witness, then the judgment is passed on to them and the sentence is passed on to them. We see that in our own court system today. If someone lies in court, they get arrested and stuff happens. They don't get stoned, but it's a justice precedent that a false witness has to bear some punishment. And in the Jewish system, the false witness bears the punishment that he inflicted on a potentially innocent person. Even if they're not innocent, if they're false, then they get that judgment. So this is why the men start leaving. And the record that we have tells us that they leave oldest to youngest. It's because the oldest one there has the responsibility for casting that first stone. And so obviously no one wants to take that responsibility. They've been shown that they're sinners. Possibly they are false witnesses. We don't know. Okay, they don't go away embarrassed because Jesus has exposed them as sinners. They do not go away embarrassed. They go away mad. Okay, they are extremely angry because they have just had the tables turned on them. Jesus was supposed to start the insurrection or was supposed to be shown as a craven coward. He did not. He turned the tables and made them make the choice to start the insurrection or to be exposed as cowardly. So that's why I think it's so brilliant of him writing in the dust. So Jesus elevated the question. It's no longer a question of should we obey God's law or should we obey Roman law. The question is now one of justice and mercy. Justice kills, mercy reconciles. So we're getting close here to why this story is a picture of God's atonement action for us. So now it's just Jesus and the woman. The crowd is gone. The woman before has not been an important part of the story. She's just a pawn in the story. She's just someone used to elevate the question from a rhetorical question to an actual question. So nobody cared about her until now. It's just Jesus and the woman. And now she becomes the focal point of the story. So here's a problem, though. Her sin has not been atoned for because she has not paid the price that the law demanded. The execution of a criminal, that stoning process, that was seen by the Jews as an atonement process. So this woman is outside of the temple system. She's considered a sinner, so she has to have some means of atonement before God. Her death, her blood, would be that atonement, and that would ensure her eternal life, her acceptance with God by her death would do that. Okay, Jesus does not acquit her. He doesn't say, oh, really, you didn't really sin all that badly, so it's okay. You can go on home and don't worry about it. He does not acquit her. He says, okay, here we are. Go and sin no more. He says, leave your life of sin. But he does not condemn her. Condemning would be handing her over to the law for the law to take for the law to do its process, okay? So he does not hand her over to the law. He has deflected the anger of the Jewish authorities from the woman. Remember, they were mad at her for breaking the law. He has deflected that anger from her onto himself. When he wrote in the dust and her sentence blew away, they're angry at Jesus. They can't be angry at her anymore, but they're angry at Jesus. So Jesus has redeemed her from the wrath of the Jewish authorities, from the wrath of the law. And Jesus has drawn that wrath onto himself. So he forgives her. but he does not forgive her at the cost of the embarrassment or to the shame of the men who were standing there. He does not forgive her because of that. He forgives her at his own cost because he's drawn the anger onto himself. So this is his first step toward the cross. He is interpreting, right here, he's interpreting his own death, what that link is going to be between his death and the redemption of his people, the atonement of his people. So he's going to die, and when he dies, it's going to be for that one woman's sin. And all the other people, all the other individuals that he's going to encounter. So he has shown his mercy to that woman because of the fact that he knows her sin will be atoned for. It doesn't have to be atoned immediately, but it will be atoned, and he knows that. Atonement is going to be made. So this picture is a very real picture to the people who are standing there watching what's going on here. So her condemnation, her sins have been written in the dust. The dust has been blown away. Jesus' death that he has brought on himself, because bringing the wrath of the law on himself, that death will pay the price that the law demands for this sin. She stands before God with her sins atoned for because of Jesus' action here. Jesus' death is not just the death of another good man. Lots of good men have died. But Jesus' actions here show the link, the beginning, that story I told you about the guy jumping in the well to save somebody. Jesus' actions here show that link. They show the connection between our sins. We're floundering at the bottom of a well. Jesus jumps into the well, and his action in jumping in saves us from that well. The connection is unmistakable. Jesus died so that we can live. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for being here with us, and thank you that your actions can speak to us even today, even louder than sometimes what our words when we try to explain what we mean. Let us keep an eye on your actions, and let us try to understand and apply them to our own lives as we, as religious leaders in our world, try to understand what you want us to do. In your name, amen. Yeah. When Stephen was stoned, remember that Saul, who became Paul, was the main accuser. Remember when they laid the coats at his feet? That was symbolic, showing that he was the guy in charge of what's going on. And then the stoning itself was the lynch mob idea, that Stephen was not allowed to be stoned by Roman law, so they had to take it on themselves. The same with Paul when he was stoned later. He was out in the provinces when he was stoned, so it's not really clear whether or not the Romans cared about what was going on out there, but that was very obviously a lynch mob. So at this point in history, any stoning that happened was an illegal act. So yeah, thanks for asking that. Yeah. Right, and the reason I don't agree with that is, first of all, because most of them could not have read what he wrote in the dirt. So the point is not what he wrote in the dirt. We don't know the words that he wrote, but just the fact that he wrote in the dirt, and they would have expected the writing to be the sentence to be carried out. So. Anybody else? I mean,
I have an update on Roger. Do you want to read?
Oh, okay, sure.
Since you're right, and I'm not.
Yeah. Okay, update on Roger. This is from Carrie. We were able to bring our dad home Friday. It was a good day for all of us. He does still have the drain in his heart, and unfortunately the fluids are not slowing down yet. It will be good for him to rest at home for a few days. He has an appointment with the heart doctor February 10th, and we're praying they see great improvement.